I am Reese Tisdale, and this is Future of Water, in which we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're celebrating the future of water and I guess what I would call a success. Yes, this is our 50th episode. Who would have ever thought a couple of years ago when we decided to finally launch that we'd even get to 50, but I guess that was the plan all along, and we'll charge forward from 50 to hopefully 100 and beyond. So I'm not going to lie, it took us a while to even kick this whole thing off at the beginning, but really has become a key piece of our product and channel strategy at Bluefield Research. And quite honestly, it's also gone amazingly fast, not without headaches, not without some laughs, not without some just general ridiculousness in coming up with ideas and conversations, some of which has been cut out. But, you know, for us at Bluefield, fortunately, we have a mountain of water market insights to talk about. So far, we have relied heavily, if not exclusively, on our team of water experts to talk about what's happening in the world, where things are happening, and what the future of water looks like. So, you know, in doing so, hopefully we've given all the listeners out there that have downloaded episodes from 1 to 50 some good insights on what's happening. I can't say it's exhaustive because there's so much to talk about. So today we're going to bring in a couple of my colleagues, actually three, to sort of talk a little bit about a little further out on some key trends in the digital water space, global and or industrial, water for energy, some big picture trends. So I've got Keith Hayes, colleague and partner. I've got Steph Aldock, as well as Eric Bendler coming in to join us for this conversation. So rather than revel in the glory of 50 episodes for what that's worth, let's get into the conversation with my colleagues and talk about the future of water.
Morning, everyone. I'm Steph Aldock. I'm joined by my colleagues, Reese Tisdale, Keith Hayes, and Eric Bendler. Bluefield's a global company, but I think this is the first time we've had the podcast in four different locations. Keith, how's it going in Barcelona?
It's going good, Steph. It's hot over here, and we could use more rain.
Okay. Reese, what's the good word in Boston?
All right. So good word is it's old school. I'm back in the house again. My whole family has COVID except for me. So here's to the J&J vaccine. Kudos to that one. And secondly, the Boston Celtics start the NBA Finals tonight. So all is good, at least for the day.
Go Warriors. Eric, how's it going in Chicago?
It's going well. Just rolling into summer. It's baseball season. Trying to go to a Cubs game this weekend. So happy to be out in the world again.
Nice. And for the record, I'm in the Bay Area where water, or should I say lack thereof, is always top of mind here. So let's go ahead and jump in. For context, we've been kicking around ideas for podcasts. This is actually our 50th episode, which feels pretty momentous. And we decided to be true to the podcast name. So today we're going to look forward to the future of water. I also want to give special thanks to our sound guru, Mike Gaylor, for producing all these episodes for us. It's kind of hard to believe this is our 50th, but there's a lot to talk about in water. So what I want to do today is just throw out some questions to each of you, get your perspective on markets of interest, and the others can chime in as they see fit. So here we go. What is the most interesting and potential disruptor in water for the next 5-10 years? You can even look further ahead. What are some signals of change, and how will the competitive landscape be impacted? So who will be the winners and who will be the losers? So Eric, I kind of have a hunch on what you're going to say, but let's start with you. What do you think will be the disruptor for the future of water?
Sure. So I'll take it from the, you know, the perspective of digital water, which is kind of my wheelhouse. And before I answer the question about the, you know, kind of potential disruptors, I want to set a little bit of context and partly give a bit of a plug for our upcoming Global Digital Water Forecast, which is going to be out the next couple of days, beginning of next week, where we look at digital water spend across 45 countries, 34 different technology segments. And as I've been working through this report and the numbers, one of the biggest takeaways that really jumps out to me is just the extreme fragmentation of the water, wastewater utility sector on a global scale. We talk about it a lot in the US, but those patterns also hold true in many other key global markets. just the diversity of kind of market opportunities that results from that fragmentation. I'm not going to give away too many specifics. Definitely go check out the report if you want to see some of the individual numbers and projections. But I'll say we expect somewhere between around $380 and $390 billion in total global spending over this decade, right? Between 2021 and 2030. So cumulative spend on hardware, software, services. And when you kind of look at that at a high level, there's really three main buckets of types of market opportunities that jump out. About 40% goes to large urban utilities that serve more than 100,000 people in your wealthy kind of upper income countries like North America, countries in Western or Northern Europe, the Gulf states, you know, Australia, for example. So 40% of the market, you know, for those kind of upper tier, upper income countries, 30% for small and mid-sized utilities in those same countries, and another 30% for kind of emerging markets like China, Brazil, South Africa, India. And really the bulk of the market, so much of vendor concentration and focus has been on that first 40%, right? Those really large urban, wealthier utilities in upper income countries. And what I'm interested in when I think about the future of digital water, it's really what does the industry need to do to actually democratize access to these technologies, to get technology into the hands of that other 60%, right? The small and mid-sized utilities and the emerging market utilities. What can the industry do to really unlock that level of adoption? What types of advances, what types of disruptions do we need to ensure that vendors are able to scale their solutions down in terms of price point, in terms of complexity, to make sure that utilities with, you know, limited budgets, with limited technical capacity are actually able to use them, to make use of them, to benefit from them. And so back to the original question, you know, it is partly a technology question, certainly. I mean, I think cloud computing has played a major role so far in helping to scale some of those solutions down, in making software accessible to utilities that don't have a full-time IT staff, that can't afford to maintain their own, you know, on-premise software. You know, certainly also just continuing advances in just low cost sensors and hardware, you know, current supply chain disruptions and inflation may be excluded there, but the long-term trends towards lower cost hardware, lower cost analytics software, you know, the kind of commoditization of analytics, all of those trends are important. I think we're going to keep seeing them. They're going to continue to open up access to technology. But the real disruption here in my mind is going to be business models, right? In terms of new ways of selling and procuring and maintaining technology and digital services that are going to make them more accessible to smaller and to emerging market utilities. And so that could be software as a service or data as a service, network as a service. It could be, you know, more regional or joint procurement models. It could be utility consolidation and all of the kind of opportunities for technology adoption that stem from that. But I think that's really where we're going to see the change, and that's really where we're going to see the disruption. And we're going to have to, if this kind of digital water revolution, as we're billing it, is going to actually continue to grow beyond the, you know, 1.5% of really large wealthy utilities that have kind of driven the market so far.
If I could follow up with that, Eric, I mean, I guess one question that comes out of that and your point about looking at, let's say, emerging markets or smaller systems, is there any, not to ambush you with a question, but are there leapfrogging technologies or solutions out there that may be better suited or have advantages when the existing infrastructure is less prevalent in certain markets, whether it be sub-Saharan Africa or maybe parts of Asia or Latin America? Or is there anything out there that it may enable companies? I mean, now, sort of like mobile telephony back in the day. I mean, there was a point like where instead of laying landlines, you know, many of these developing markets became connected because of mobile telephony, right? So it just sort of leapfrogged traditional solutions or landline technologies. Is there anything in water or digital water, should I say, that may be enabled because of just the current environments outside of these large systems and or richer systems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably one of the most obvious examples of that would be in the metering world, right? If you're talking about, you know, AMR, which is basically walk-by or drive-by meter reading, where it's partly, you know, partly remote in the sense that there is kind of a signal being transmitted from the meter, but you still need to send crews to drive down the street and actually collect those signals, versus fully remote AMI or cellular-based or LoRa-based types of kind of fully remote metering technology. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, in some of the more developed markets, in upper income utilities, where these investments in kind of digital solutions have been made over time. You know, there was that kind of initial investment in AMR technology, and now the move is to migrate from that over to AMI. You know, there's costs associated with that, versus if you look at emerging markets, and even places like Australia, for example, which I think we certainly consider in more of that, you know, advanced economy group, AMR just didn't really take off to the same extent. And so when utilities are migrating to smart metering or digital metering, they're typically jumping straight into fully remote, whether that be a fixed AMI network or some other type of comms solution. So certainly I think that's an opportunity. The other piece would be, especially in emerging markets where we're seeing a lot of population growth, where we're seeing a lot of urbanization, we're seeing new water, wastewater, stormwater infrastructure being put in the ground. There's an opportunity to kind of make that smart, make that digital to begin with. And so that's what we're seeing, you know, in India, for example, to the extent that we're seeing investment in digital water. And it's a very small scale at this point, but what we're seeing is a lot of these kind of greenfield smart city projects where, you know, they're kind of building infrastructure, they're building new 24/7 water, wastewater systems with SCADA already kind of in the mix, with smart meters already in the mix, with some sort of IoT or telemetry already in the mix, as opposed to having to go back and build that in later, kind of retrofit or open the infrastructure back up and outfit it with those digital capabilities. So I think that's another really important part of the conversation. Just getting the technology in there to begin with makes it cheaper. It enables a different type of design. If you know you're going to have that data, you're going to have that access to data as you're kind of designing and building the infrastructure.
Yeah. I remember we were first talking about digital water and we were like, should we call it digital or smart water? You know, just the overall opportunity. I think what strikes me is for your forecasts that are coming out, the 32 different categories of digital water. And I always want to, you know, place a bet on one of them and say AI or SCADA or something's going to be the winner. But I think your point about how, you know, it really depends on the market is a good one. And you know, we talk about how water is local and the opportunity changes. So I think that's a super good point. And what do you think about the players impacting digital? I mean, do you think, you know, private equity, we call them outsiders looking in, tech companies, you know, do you think they're going to have a huge impact going forward? Or do you think it'll be more of the traditional water players?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be all of the above. I mean, you know, I think we have been talking quite a bit over the past couple of years about the outsiders looking in. And I think rightfully so. I think we've seen are those predictions kind of starting to come true in a lot of ways. I mean, just the involvement of big tech companies like Amazon or Google, you know, or Microsoft, for example, taking up stronger positions in the water industry. You know, we've been talking about telecom industries, telecom companies, I should say. We put a report out about that last year, and we've continued to see companies like Telstra buy, you know, digital water companies or companies that have a digital water portfolio. We've seen companies like Vodafone in the UK offering water specific IoT solutions. So I think a lot of those predictions are coming true. And I think we'll continue to see that. What I'm interested in the past couple of months is the kind of broader tech ecosystem and how we're seeing more involvement there. So not necessarily just the big software companies that everybody knows, but, you know, the investors, right? The major kind of technology, Silicon Valley VC investors. One that comes to mind is Insight Partners, has been really active in the digital water space in the past few months. And they're, you know, major kind of tech VC player. Technology management consulting companies like KPMG or Accenture, are they going to, you know, they've got a bit of a, they're kind of on the fringes, they're on the margins. Are they going to continue to get involved as they see just the overall market continue to grow? Are they going to make more of a splash into water? That plus the kind of steady flow of new startups that we're continuing to see. I think the competitive landscape, if we think 5 or 10 years down the line, it is going to be dynamic. It's going to be fluid. I don't think we're going to see, I mean, it's a super fragmented competitive landscape. I don't think we're going to see the market as a whole become super consolidated over that time. I mean, we are going to keep seeing M&A. We're going to see consolidation activity, you know, and I think we'll see maybe more consolidation within some of those really well-defined segments, like maybe the SCADA market or the metering market, the modeling market. You know, there are these kind of pockets of competition where we see only a few players. But overall, I think there's just too much activity in the market. And there's so many different needs, right? I mean, as we're kind of talking about, depending on what part of the world you're looking at, what type of utility you're looking at, there's such a wide range of technologies and services that are out there that utilities have a demand for, that I think it's going to be really hard to see a handful of companies really dominate the market as a whole. So from the perspective of winners and losers, I mean, I think I would say, simply put, the winners are going to be the ones that can actually meet a range of needs, right? So many players within digital water are these kind of point solution providers. And it's a super effective strategy as a startup, right? If you kind of do one thing and do it really well, you get clients. But I think in order to scale and to kind of gain market share, gain kind of a leading position within the digital water market, we're going to, you know, companies are going to need to be able to do a lot of things well. They're going to need to cater to different budgets or different price points. They're going to need to be able to offer both the kind of core, you know, hardware software solutions, whether that be meters or sensors or, you know, work order management software, GIS software, SCADA. They're going to need to have that core footprint, but they're also going to need to do some of the more advanced analytics and integration and visualization tools. You know, they're going to need to be able to expand that portfolio to serve both the kind of early stage digital or utilities that are, you know, early in their digital water journey versus those that are later on that are more advanced. You know, you're going to need to offer kind of a range of options to cater to that. And then from the perspective of losers, I would say, you know, in my mind, the biggest losers are going to be existing kind of incumbent water industry players, whether they be pipe companies or pump companies or O&M services providers, just, you know, existing water industry players and brands that don't get smart about digital as soon as possible. You know, I think that's really where we're going to see the biggest loss of opportunity of market share. These players that aren't able to make that transition to get into the digital space in one way or another as quickly as they can.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about the companies with the niche solutions, because I think we're already seeing that, right? We've talked a little bit about metering companies who are now expanding their strategies and other companies getting into platforms. So that's a good point. Well, what about you, Keith? Do you see something different in Europe, rest of world versus the US in terms of the opportunity?
I think Eric covered it all. We can just go home now, end of episode 50. No, I agree a lot with what Eric and Reese were both saying. I will say, though, to be honest, I'm a little bit, I guess, allergic to, or I cringe when I hear the word disruption or disruptor with the water sector, having worked in telecoms and in renewable energy, because the way that the water sector is set up, there are huge public health issues, which make it obviously very risk averse. We're dealing with natural monopolies. We're talking about municipal water. And so, you know, change we tend to see is very incremental, I think, in general, because, you know, a public utility is going to be there forever, but a private vendor may come and go, right? So they're very cautious about when they buy software, how much they migrate to it, how much to rely on it, et cetera. Yeah. So I do think, though, if that's the case, that disruption can't really happen overnight, but there is a lot of great technology out there. What is going to move the needle in terms of increasing adoption of some of these technologies that probably have been around for a while, but haven't actually been adopted? And I think we all know water is very compliance driven. So unless there's a rule, or there's a penalty that's going to force utilities to adopt something, nothing's going to change. So I see probably two sources of disruption here. One's going to come from the regulatory angle, and that's going to be probably cracking down on specific contaminants of concern, whether we're talking about PFAS in the US or other micro pollutants in Europe. And that could require a sea change in terms of how biosolids are managed and how wastewater treatment is managed and how different sources of pollutants are identified and controlled. So I definitely see something happening there. And obviously, saying disruption and regulation doesn't get you super excited, like there's going to be a lightning bolt. It means that there's going to be politicians and lobbyists going back and forth over this for maybe another 5 to 7 years, but that's kind of how it works. Although I think we have seen, at least with PFAS, that that's starting to happen. And then the other angle, I think, related to what Eric is saying about digital is can you come up with something that gets smaller systems on that like first rung of the ladder of digital transformation? So like, what is that one thing that opens up their eyes that may have been around for decades, whether it's instead of sending paper checks, we can switch to email when we bill our customers, or instead of sending a truck out there to check on the pump station once a week, we can put this sensor on it. And all of a sudden we realize, hey, you know what? There's these things out there. We don't have to roll trucks as many times, or we don't have to send as much paper. There's little incremental things like that that add up to disruption. But, you know, I wonder if you had to pick, what is like the one thing that all utilities start out with first on their digital transformation path or ladder or whatever metaphor you want to use, what would that be? And I think Eric's right in that shifting the attention from large systems to the smaller systems, which is the vast majority, and those are the ones where there's huge inefficiencies, figuring out what is usually going to be like that first rung on the ladder, I think that could kind of be the disruptive thing, because they go from just working with what they had and everything's landlines and paper to, okay, we don't have to do everything in spreadsheets. We can start looking at other things. So it's almost like, what is that one thing that's going to create a cultural shift inside of smaller utilities? And is there like a standard thing that that might be? And it may be different for a bunch of different markets, but I think once you kind of get down, like in every market, they should just start out like sorting out their GIS, which maybe that is it. Then I think we start to see more of a shift.
Yeah. I mean, I think the regulations piece, you know, it's definitely like not sexy, but it is such a big driver, especially around the drinking water and PFAS space. One of the things, I was at the ESRI conference in Palm Springs last year, and I was struck by, you know, how much these water utilities are already doing. When we talk about digitalization, I think the water industry is, people think, oh, they're stodgy, they're slow moving, not much is happening. But actually, you know, these smaller utilities are already doing a ton of stuff in terms of digital adoption. So that's what's really struck me. What do you think, Reese? What's your choice for disruptor for the water industry?
So, yeah, I mean, as you guys know, we could probably talk about the digital piece all day. I mean, changing gears a little bit more recently, and I think maybe over time, but I'm really hopped up on it now, is really the energy piece, the water energy piece, and what's happening. And there are a couple of reasons for that. And one is, I think, is Eric and I, and I think maybe the rest of you, we've talked a little bit about it. Like, traditionally, the water sector has always been sort of the victim of climate change and drought and water stress and floods. And it's always been a matter of, oh, we don't have enough water, we've got to start conserving water, or, hey, you know. But the reality of it is, the water sector is also a contributor to climate change, whether it be, you know, pumping water from Northern California to Southern California, or just within distribution networks, or just wastewater treatment itself, which is pretty energy intensive. And then there's also the, you know, release of gases from wastewater treatment plants. So the point being is, use a lot of energy. And in some cases, for some cities and towns, it is one of the largest contributors, if not the largest contributor, to carbon emissions for a city or a town. So point being is, the spotlight is turning towards the water sector a little bit. And I think some of that is internal. I think the supply chain is really beginning to focus more on it. Companies like Xylem or Grundfos, obviously pump companies, have a vested interest in making the systems more efficient. But then on the back end, I mean, I think we're also seeing, you know, so there's the energy piece. And then the other side of that is what we saw in places like Texas, the Texas winter storm, where there's no water supplies, or California with wildfires, and South Africa as well, where we've seen Eskom is unable to deliver reliable power supplies to water utilities, and therefore there's no water supply or wastewater treatment. So while there's a focus on the utility sector's carbon emissions itself, there's also the piece of just resilience from climate, right? And so that can also be partly managing their own energy supplies through the adoption of things like microgrids or on-site power and storage. So we're starting to see that. We've seen it, you know, intermittently or sort of in fits and starts over the past couple of years, but we're, you know, rather than relying just on a diesel generator in the back lot when the power goes down, we're starting to see, I'd say, scalable, I think, that maybe it's still early stage business models to provide battery powered storage and more efficient management. And then the other part of that is, you know, and maybe this is adjacent to that, is wastewater treatment plants do produce a lot of gases. And so there's energy capture or energy to be captured or mined for other sources, whether it be to be put into the grid or even for other sort of on-site power. So we're seeing firms like NW Natural, but also public utilities as well, not just investor-owned, who are making moves in that direction. So, I mean, much like we talked a bit about the convergence of big data and digital and water, I mean, we're also starting to see that to some extent between water and the energy sector infrastructure players as well.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how interconnected water and energy really are. You just did a blog on hydrogen. Do you see that as being a game changer?
So, you know, game changer, I mean, I'm excited about it because one, I think it's interesting, you know, in many respects, there's a move. So we're starting to see what I would call, you know, well, legitimate renewable players like large power companies. You know, they've sort of gone from renewable buildup over the last decade, decade and a half globally, from China to Europe to the US and elsewhere, deploying wind and solar. So there's a lot of excess capacity or available capacity for green power. And then they've moved towards storage and battery storage to address things like backup power and address intermittency really in the grid because of all the renewables coming online. Now we're starting to see things like electric vehicles really take off on the heels or in the wake of Tesla's success. So what's next? So we're starting to see some of these larger players really look at hydrogen or hydrogen hubs to be deployed for electric power storage, use it for transportation, and maybe on-site power, depending, or even fertilizer manufacturing, ammonia, and things like that. So we're seeing hubs begin to proliferate, you know, and I'd say one thing we just saw just recently in Utah is Department of Energy just awarded a $500 million grant to the Intermountain Power Plant, which will supply LADWP with hydrogen power over time. It'll start with a mix, I think, of fuel supplies and ultimately go to hydrogen, particularly as utilities move towards greening their own power mix. Yeah, the hydrogen piece, it's probably further than 10 years out. But the reason we're talking about this for two reasons. One, water is the raw material, is the really what is supplying the plant that'll be cracked through an electrolyzer. And then, you know, the hydrogen comes out of that. And then there's some pure water that comes out of that. And then the question is, what happens with that? So there's some treatment that'll have to be had or made or happen. But also, what is the supply? Is it just going to be groundwater? Will it be surface water? It could be reclaimed wastewater. It could be desalinated water, which could be expensive. But the point is, it could be an opportunity for water utilities to also partly invest in their own system for other uses as well.
And what about market indicators? I know we're always tracking that at Bluefield. I was reading in the latest quarterly, which I do read, that natural gas was up, I think, double since last year, 300% since the start of the pandemic. I mean, do you think fuel prices are a signal to watch going forward?
Yeah, I mean, Keith could probably speak more to this than I can. I mean, gas prices in the U.S. have gone up significantly. In Europe, it's a whole nother, you know, ball of wax. It's kind of crazy given what's happening in Russia and the Ukraine. It was happening before that, but partly because of Russia's influence on the European gas markets. But I just read the other day that Iberdrola is increasing its residential gas prices 140% in Spain. So for heating. So if anything, it'll be an accelerant. There may be some good timing, you know, with companies like Total and Veolia partnering to capture renewable gases on site. I think they're looking at 15 countries around the world in markets, municipal, but also they may even be looking at dairies as well. It's an accelerant. So, but yeah, I mean, I think, and Keith and I talked a little bit about this on a podcast, I think in March earlier this year, just about sort of the looming stress on European markets specifically, but it's not unique to Europe. It just may be far more acute these days.
Yeah, I think particularly on the industrial side, I mean, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of ways to capture energy, whether it's, you know, biogas capture or optimizing the way that pumping happens when you're moving water through a factory. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a reality. I mean, there are multiple reasons to become energy efficient, just cost cutting, decarbonization. But, you know, I think it's becoming more and more of a reality for sure here in Europe with the whole push towards circular economy and how that's manifesting itself in different industrial verticals.
So that's a great segue. None of you guys answered corporate sustainability or ESG, which I actually kind of find kind of surprising. What do you think? Do you think that's just hype? Do you think it's going to have a huge impact on the water industry going forward? I know there's some differing views here.
Well, I mean, technically it should mean that it'll have less of an impact in the sense that their water footprint will get smaller, right? It'll become more efficient, maybe through acquiring different leak management technologies or sourcing their water differently. I mean, I think, you know, the move that the corporates are saying, it's going to take some years, I think, to find its way from, you know, a statement to every factory has got some sort of reuse program in place. But it definitely seems like that's where things are going.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, there's a lot of buzz, right? I mean, it just, you know, to play the other side of that coin, I mean, it's sort of like corporate social responsibility, whether that was probably 10, 20 years ago, not that it's, I don't know how different it ultimately is, but, you know, that took up a lot, created a lot of noise, took up a lot of oxygen in the conversation. I do think the ESG piece is real. And quite honestly, I don't necessarily think it's not being overlooked here. I think it's actually really critical because at the end of the day, what his point was earlier is that the municipal sector is slow, it's risk averse, it is, you know, very methodical, if that's one way to put it, how it acts in the marketplace. But the industrials or commercials, they do look more, I don't want to say more closely, but they're more reactive or proactive in managing their bottom line. So, you know, in some cases, it may require some upfront capital costs or expenditures to bring in water solutions and technologies, but then the OPEX ultimately operating costs will ultimately go down, at least as far as like water usage, water supplies, and also just mitigating risk. And there's no doubt that when you, it's in the news every day, the market is calling for it. I mean, we've spoken to some clients and customers who have basically said, you know, on the industrial side, ESG or moves in that direction kind of take higher priority than a lot of other decisions that they're making, even if the ROI, return on investment, is further out than what is typical. Because they think companies and industrials, particularly the consumer-based companies, those that have a direct, you know, that are B2C, you know, they think that and see that, I think maybe the data shows that their customers are, this is what they're looking for. They're looking for some responsibility. Is there a bunch of noise? Absolutely. So, I mean, I think everybody needs a little bit of a reality check. And maybe the reality check, not to be a downer, could be a recession. It'll be interesting to see how people respond. It could also accelerate it, right? Where companies say, hey, we need to find other ways to cut costs. Ultimately, is this a way to do it? And water and or carbon, they do go hand in hand. I think to date, most of the focus has been on carbon emissions. Like I was saying, water does play a role. It costs money to treat water. It costs money to purchase water. It costs money to distribute water. So, you know, there's a part of that.
If I could add a couple of things, I know we got to wrap up in a minute, but the ESG conversation, I think, is really interesting because there's kind of two ways to think about it. I mean, there's basically ESG for a company or utility or whatever, a gauge of their impact on the planet, their carbon emissions, their water use, et cetera. But it's also the planet's impact on them, right? It's kind of, you know, their resilience to climate impacts or to water scarcity. And whether ESG is really measuring one or the other, I think both kind of do go hand in hand. And there's obviously a water element to both, right? If we're talking about or companies, you know, corporates being evaluated on how resilient they would be to a water shock or to a lack of water in their, you know, for their manufacturing facilities, for their data centers, it's going to get them thinking about water as a key risk. And the more that they do think about that risk, the more that they may also start to think about solutions, right? I think that's really, in a lot of ways, what we're seeing with big tech companies. Many of them are, their kind of way into water is thinking, how do we make sure that we have a reliable source of water to, you know, cool our data centers? And actually, wow, this is a big problem. Maybe we can apply some of our analytics. Maybe we can apply some of our, you know, big data capabilities to help address these challenges, to help manage or monitor or assess water risk. And I think that pathway is a really interesting thing to watch. But either way, I think, I mean, Reese, to your point about B2C companies and that kind of customer demand for ESG, for sustainability, it's also investors, right? I think that the more that the ESG conversation develops, the more we're seeing investors, you know, there's certainly plenty of greenwashing out there. There's no doubt that there is, but we are seeing more, I think, sophistication in terms of really assessing and finding out, you know, really putting some kind of objective metrics or measurements to kind of how sustainable a company really is or how resilient they really are. And then financing kind of being dictated by that. I mean, I know that some utilities even are thinking about that. They're making investments in sustainability and ESG because they want to get more attractive financing. And if investors are taking it seriously, if, you know, the kind of debt providers, the bondholders, the equity investors, if this is a priority for them, it's going to have to be a priority for the companies and the utilities and the organizations that are, you know, getting investment from them. Right. And I think that's kind of an important indicator to keep in mind.
I think that last point's a really good one that even we at Bluefield sometimes, I'd say, overlook on the municipal or utility side. There is value in that for themselves as well.
Yeah. So personally, I'm really interested to see what happens in corporate sustainability. But at Bluefield, so we offer 8 different corporate subscriptions across all aspects of water. And I think, you know, especially being in marketing, we're always thinking, oh, you know, is it going to be reuse that changes the game? Is it going to be industrial or digital industrial? And, you know, there's so much change happening in all of aspects of water as we think about, you know, a lot of the ones you guys have touched on today. So it's pretty exciting. So with that, I think we'll wrap up. But thanks, guys, for your time today. It's been fun and super informative. And I look forward to doing our next 50 episodes.
All right. Happy 50. Happy 50 more.
Yeah, happy 50 and nice work. 5 years ago, I don't think we could have done it 5 years ago from Barcelona to Chicago to Boston to San Francisco. So I'm impressed with technology in and of itself. All right, guys, thanks a million. Thanks, Steph, for emceeing the whole event, and Eric and Keith, good to see you guys. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
All right, so there you have it. Before we sign off, please subscribe to the Future Water podcast and give us a review. And if you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, send us a note at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. And lastly, tell a friend about it. Always a good thing to do. I just spoke to a friend yesterday for the first time in 25 years. So, hey, it's a good feeling. So at the very least, why don't you send a friend a podcast that you might find interesting and you think they'll find interesting. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and take care.